Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 350. Wednesday, November 27th, 2019.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, happy Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is tomorrow, but I'm guessing most of you won't listen to this today. And, if Thanksgiving is passed, I hope it went well. If you were visiting relatives that you don't see often, I hope that conversations remained non-political. I remember biting my tongue when visiting my father's in-laws for holiday dinners and such. His father-in-law was, there's no gentle way to put it. He was a vile racist. And after years of these gatherings, he never did come to, understand that I wasn't really going to laugh along with his racist jokes. I'm sure he's dead now. Not that he was a horrible person across the board, but that was definitely his vice. Alrighty, well, to start off, I am going to revisit a portion of my conversation with Harvey J.K. So I'm guessing most of you have heard the most recent episode of the Sea Realm podcast. That was episode number 552, Radicals and Reactionaries. So if you have heard it, well, you're going to hear part of it again, just about 10 minutes worth. And if you haven't heard it, well, don't worry. This bit that I'm about to play is from the very beginning of that conversation, so it requires no context. I put this bit up as a video. And, I've gotten several people on Zoom, people that I thought would be sympathetic to the Freedom Dividend or Andrew Yang's universal basic income proposal. And so far, nobody that I have talked to has been in favor of it. And spoiler alert, Harvey J.K. is no exception. So here is the portion of the most recent Sea Realm podcast that I put up as a video. Let's start off with something that I'm going to excerpt and put out as just a little short video.
Okay.
This will be to throw some red meat to the Yang Gang. You write quite a bit about and reference Thomas Paine.
Right.
One of the lesser known so-called founding fathers intellectual founders.
Can I just say lesser known in the sense that he's not on the National Mall with a monument? But as we can talk about it in a little while, if you'd like, in every generation, every progressive movement in American history, when it reached back to lay claim to the revolution, grabbed hold of Thomas Paine and made him one of their sort of historical figures, their champions, every single one. I did this book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, which details all of that, to my surprise, because I thought, too, that he was generally suppressed as a figure in memory.
Well, I've been excited about the candidacy of Andrew Yang. I'm not a huge fan of universal basic income, but he's the only candidate who seems to be speaking with any sort of knowledge and authority about the technological transformation that's taking place under our feet right now and the effects that it has on people's ability to make a life, a living.
Mm-hmm.
In arguing for the universal basic income, though, he often references Thomas Paine. But as I understand Thomas Paine's proposal, it wasn't really so much a recurring income as a sort of like an inheritance from the state that you got.
Okay, you want me to explain what Paine had
please.
To say? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll just preface it by saying that I received a number of calls from the media, including PolitiFact, asking me was Andrew Yang on target in saying that his argument for universal basic income was grounded in Thomas Paine's work? And I said that one could imagine why they thought that, but there is a difference. So Paine did not argue for a universal basic income. He didn't argue for an annual payment by the state, not at all. What it is that Paine believed, he was a deist, not an atheist. He believed that God had created the universe, And essentially what he said is he created the earth for all to enjoy. But basically, as he well recognized and everyone recognized, there were gross inequalities in property holding. There were those who would become large, landed, rich. This was true, especially in Europe, but equally so in good parts of the United States. So his argument was that those folks who had those property holdings owed everyone else a tax. And that tax that they would pay would go into some kind of national fund or a community trust, or if you like, a national treasury. But it would be a special fund. And out of that fund, there would be two kinds of payments made. Paine's commitment was to end poverty. Okay, that was the fundamental. So he said, first of all, it should be the case that this fund affords what we would think of today as old age pensions or social security to men and women reaching the age of maturity, which I don't remember if it was 55 in common sense or 60, but the point was at the age of maturity, there would be a payment made to those folks to fight poverty. But the second thing is that if you're going to fight poverty, you should fight it early on, okay? And so he argued that out of this fund, every boy and girl, and by the way, that was a rather feminist position to take, it wasn't just young men, every boy and girl on reaching the age of maturity should be granted a stake, S-T-A-K-E, a sum of money to enable them, okay, to either, you know, set up a business, secure some kind of education, secure land for themselves. This, he said, would afford a real sense of, he didn't use the word opportunity, I don't believe, but basically it's a sense that they had a propulsion of an economic sort to their lives. So when Andrew Yang argues for universal basic income, one can imagine how he could see it rooted in Thomas Paine's thinking, but Paine did not argue for an annual payment to all citizens. Does that get to the question?
Well, that's definitely a good start. And I guess the follow-up, and this will be, you know, the red meat for the Yang gang, is what's your opinion on the freedom dividend proposal?
I don't favor universal basic income. In part, it's a practical thing. And it's the fact that I believe work is an expression of our humanity. But the ways in which we're compelled to work is often a denial of that humanity. And so what I would say is that are we so uncreative as a species that we cannot imagine, even with the changes in technology, that other kinds of human activity, which we might or might not want to call work, would not be made available? I mean, I would argue that there ought to be a greater redistribution of income. I'm decidedly in favor of a democratic socialist project. The idea of an annual payment, here's my fear about that universal basic income. That will be seen, I should add one other thing, that Paine said that everyone would receive the old age pension and everyone would receive the original payment to young people. That there was, in that sense, it's not unlike Andrew Yang's perhaps universal basic income. But the thing is that they had to accept it. They could give it back, but they had to accept it because he did not want either the old age pensions or the young people's grants to be seen in any fashion as a charity. And that's essential. Now, to the extent the universal basic income might actually be just that, okay, not a charity, that it would be truly a universal, that's a good idea. But it's also the case that in the context of this corporate capitalist order, to give people an annual, you know, payment might well just lead to higher rents on poor people, or any number of other raises in costs for the poor and working poor. So I don't see that as a way of addressing the gross inequalities and truly the kind of poverty that persists in this country. I just don't. And so as a consequence, I don't see that in any sense as an immediate project.
All right. So there's Harvey J.K. And he said, and this is not an exact quote, but you know, something to the effect of, work is an expression of our humanity, but in the current system, a lot of us are forced to work in a way that denies our humanity. I really like that second part because, you know, I get from a lot of people, you know, I'll mention the topic of universal basic income and they will reject it. And they'll say, you know, work is about more than just getting money. Work is, it's an important part of life. But I only ever hear this from people who have good jobs or people who are just wealthy. I never hear this from people who work shitty jobs. You know, the person who is working 40 hours a week or more from multiple employers, but still paying more than half of their income in rent. Those are not the people who say, oh, you know, work is an expression of my humanity. And I wouldn't, even if I won the lottery, I'd still come in here and make these Subway sandwiches. I agree. Work is hugely important to the extent that, you know, I have, to the extent possible, crafted my own career and sacrificed the consistency and dependability of, you know, a relationship, an ongoing relationship with a big corporate employer. Because the only times I've ever had healthcare as an adult were when I was working for big companies, you know, contract work or under the table work or, you know, the sort of small scale cooperative work that I've done on, you know, in many contexts. None of that ever provided the sorts of things that corporate employment provides. And yet, the corporate employment was so dehumanizing and so disagreeable that, you know, I've spent most of my life away from it. By choice. All right, so now I'm going to read some feedback that I got on YouTube. And I'm guessing most of these people are not C. Rome Vault subscribers. The first one that I want to read comes from David, who writes, "Good conversation. I think it is important to remember how new business incentives will change with the new American scorecard combined with UBI. UBI, of course, is Universal Basic Income. If GDP remained as the only measurement, then there could be abuses of UBI." All right, what's he talking about with this new American scorecard? Well, that is something from Andrew Yang's website and his, you know, his platform. So reading now from yang2020.com, policy, improve the American scorecard. Traditionally, the economy has been measured by looking at the gross domestic product, GDP, or the stock market. Employment rates and household income are also used to measure how the average worker is doing. However, even the creator of the GDP admits that it doesn't really reflect the full story, and as economic inequality rises and the fruits of society's labors accrue to fewer individuals, it's become obvious that we need to expand our definition of economic prosperity past a single number. The bottom 80% of Americans only own 8% of stocks, and rising GDP has virtually no relationship with each citizen's well-being. When you measure something, you implicitly set your policy goals. By focusing our measurement on GDP, we've promoted production over all else. It's time to start measuring economic prosperity using a wider index that measures human as well as monetary indicators, such as, but not limited to, quality of life and health-adjusted life expectancy, happiness, well-being and mental health, environmental quality, affordability, childhood success rates, underemployment, income inequality, consumer and student debt, work and civic engagement levels, volunteerism, infant mortality, quality of infrastructure, access to education, marriage and divorce rates, substance abuse and related deaths, national optimism, personal dynamism, economic mobility. In short, why use GDP as a proxy for how Americans are doing when we can easily measure that well-being directly? Let's start an American scorecard, directly measuring the things that we should be focusing on. So then further on down on the page, he goes into some more specifics about creating those measurements. But I won't continue reading from the Andrew Yang 2020 website. I was looking at the Twitter feed of a friend of mine, and I saw that he'd made several posts on the night of the debate, and he said, you know, I love Andrew Yang, but he's just not the president. And I'm basically in the same boat. I mean, I absolutely dig everything he has to say. And yet I have no expectation whatsoever that he's going to win the nomination. I think if he did win the nomination, he'd beat Trump pretty handily. But he's got to appeal to the Democratic Party establishment. And he simply doesn't. And he absolutely doesn't appeal to the media. The media, you know, have conducted a pretty thorough blackout on Andrew Yang. And also, you know, I was just reading from Andrew Yang's website there, and there was a mention of the relationship between goals and measurements. And I forget where I heard this recently, but it stuck with me. When you make a measurement your goal, it ceases to be a measurement, which is to say, you know, as soon as you reward or punish workers based on measurements, well, they're going to do everything in their power to game those measurements such that those measurements stop being reliable indicators of anything. For example, when I worked at Amazon.com, it was just expected that, you know, in the customer service department, you were to answer 500 emails a week. Well, there would be people who would just, you know, go through the email queue looking for the easy ones and, you know, just answering those. That's one way to, you know, rack up a big score. But even worse than that was people would, they would get a hard question via email and they would just shoot back some completely irrelevant verbiage that's just cut and paste from, you know, a script. We called it a blurb archive, which didn't help the person, you know, didn't help the customer at all. It made the customer have to write back and explain again. And, you know, I got these second contacts again and again. And so I might have to, you know, stop and take 10 or 15 minutes to untangle a hairy problem that had come up. And that counts as one message answered. Whereas the person who got the original question and just shot back something irrelevant, they also got credit for one message answered. But I solved the problem. They exacerbated the problem. And yet, you know, the measurement is identical for both actions. So basically, when you have a, you know, a clunky metric like that, and you attach significant real-world consequences to that metric, people are going to cheat. That's just, it's how we do. That's how it goes. All right, next message. Next response to the video of the audio you just heard. Voltes 5 writes, Freedom Dividend is 21st revision of Thomas Paine's idea, solving poverty and inequality. We the people need to feel the inclusion of the progress in our society, hence a more vibrant American citizen. Okay, this is obviously a Yang devotee, and I have no problem with that. I mean, it's clunkily written, probably composed on a phone, I'm guessing. And here's the problem I have. Solving poverty and inequality. One, that's not a sentence, but, you know, I'm not here to pick at people's, you know, their sentence construction. Universal basic income absolutely will not solve poverty and inequality. I mean, if everybody gets the freedom dividend and they get the same amount, everybody's income rises by the same amount. That's not solving inequality. Inequality is absolutely preserved there. I think the argument is that, you know, people will have money to spend and that will be great for the economy. And, you know, that's probably true, but it's not going to do anything to address inequality. And, you know, Yuval Noah Harari in his book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, he addresses the topic of universal basic income, and he too is opposed to it. And he says really what it is. I mean, given the fact that it's mostly, you know, Silicon Valley billionaires who are really on fire for this idea of paying everybody $1,000 a month, he says, look, to them, this is just a moral sop. This is just something to make them feel a little bit better about the fact that they have captured this huge amount of wealth by doing really destructive things. I mean, it is still coming to light just how deliberately Facebook and other social media sites manipulated human neurology, figured out how to stimulate reward circuits in the brain to give users hits of dopamine in response to actions, to condition people to always want to look at their phone, to always want to scroll and look for something new, to get validation. This has been, you know, from my perspective, incredibly destructive on the relationships between different classes, relationships between people. I mean, there are people whose company I really enjoy in real life who I cannot stand on Facebook. That used to be the case when I was on Facebook. Now I don't see that side of them anymore, and I like them better than I did. But yeah, universal basic income is many things. But one thing that it is it is a soothing ointment for the conscience of the uber rich. Now, I have to say, a lot of people in that uber rich category on the right wing side don't seem to have much of a conscience. Or, you know, they think that we live in a perfect meritocracy. The amount of money that you have represents the amount of value that you've created for other people. And if you're broke, it means that you're morally deficient. You need to work harder, and you need to get smart about how you spend your time and resources. And, you know, surely there is some element of truth to that, but it is not a complete reduction of the moral universe. Next comment. Jack Ripper writes, "These boomers don't understand. People value work. Humans are a beast of burden. They will not stop working just because they receive $1,000 a month. It is not enough. What it does is, it gives poor people a means of sustenance and support to find work. It means lower middle class Americans will not live paycheck to paycheck. It means citizens have a sense of belonging to a country which is the richest in the world. Harvey's arguments are so archaic. Work is not just 8 to 5. Socialist and capitalist binary mentality bullcrap are the fucking reason this country is so fucked up. It's the fucking 21st century. You don't fucking ask Franklin D. Roosevelt, Reagan, Nixon, or old man Bernie for solutions. Guess what? Europe and China tried socialist, capitalist, or a combination of solutions already. Look where they are now. They have the same problem as we have. Brexit, rise of the alt-right, massive inequality, and the existence of an oligarch class. The freedom dividend is not a band-aid either. It's a foundation to which you can stand to figure out your way forward." And in response to that comment, Greg Wilde wrote, "That, and they have no clue how their generation allowed things to get so screwed up and don't realize how disillusioned and pissed off the people are at how corrupt our government and the big economic players are. He is right, however, that we as a people can achieve good, even great things." All right, I'll pause there and say, you know, if you're listening in the future, we're in the midst of the okay boomer phase right now, where, as usual, Generation X has been forgotten. And in this instance, I'm fine with that. But millennials and Zoomers, or, you know, Generation Z, are really pissed off with self-satisfied boomers, you know, who came up in a very prosperous time and take absolute full credit for their prosperity, their continued prosperity in tough economic times, when people who are just getting started with their lives and careers, you know, their adult lives anyway, are really having to struggle. And so when some boomer, you know, busts out with some bromide about the value of hard work and, you know, how you can achieve the American dream if you just behave right and make the right choices, it is such a satisfying thing to say, "Okay, boomer." And I've said it to somebody. I didn't say it. I posted it on Slack to one person who had absolutely no indication that she understood that somebody with an opiate addiction could be an actual human being. And that, you know, if they could only get off the drugs, they could get a job and become a member, you know, a productive member of society. And I just, you know, excerpted, "become a productive member of society," put it in quotes, and said, "Okay, boomer." But I've had people, you know, use that "okay, boomer." They've applied it to me in comments to videos. So, and I didn't like it. One, because I'm not a boomer. But two, you know, it's like being called a normie. Compared to, you know, the off-the-wall positions that some people take, yeah, I'm fairly conservative. I'm fairly, you know, straight-laced. But I don't like being called a normie, even though normie is short for neurotypical. And, you know, honestly, I don't believe I am neurotypical. But still, I don't like it. And I can empathize with, you know, boomers who thought that they had done everything right, thought that they, you know, their retirement was secured, and then got sick and discovered that, you know, the portion of their medical bills not covered by their insurance or by Medicare destroyed them financially. You know, the group that is leading the U.S. in suicide is middle-aged men. You know, one, because a lot of them are disillusioned and despairing and they feel useless. But two, you know, men are more likely to use a firearm to commit suicide, and therefore they are more likely to succeed. Women are more likely to attempt suicide than men, but they mostly fail in those attempts because they take half measures. Okay, somebody who regularly comments on my videos, Sanguine Sofrasine, I think is how to pronounce that moniker, posted, "Thanks for uploading the clip. It seems getting an expert to support UBI remains a Charlie Brown and the football story." So I've asked several regular C-Realm guests, you know, just to get on Zoom and record a short video with me. And I ask them about UBI, and every single one of them is against it. So it's like Charlie Brown, Lucy's holding the football. Charlie Brown runs to kick it, and she pulls it out of the way, and he lands up flat on his back. Vince writes, "Like it or not, UBI is a great start to move our country in a different direction, a new change. I'm getting tired of bailing out banks and corporations year after year." Well, amen to that, Vince. John Crab 67 writes, "I don't really see any red meat with Professor K's argument." And I'll just stop there and say, yeah, that's true. That's because I didn't know what Professor K was going to say before I asked him the question. I thought that he would probably, you know, given that he's a big Thomas Paine fan, I thought he would be the one, you know, that I'd finally found the guy who would say, yes, we do need to support people. But nope. So I thought there would be red meat there, and there wasn't. John Crab 67 continues, "As to Professor K's point on work being an expression to self-worth, only to have that work of self-expression often denied by the system, we have a bit of a trap or a catch-22. So how does one break the linkage that traps those people in these situations? According to Professor K's work on pain, opportunity for self-expression and work comes from having the resources to make it happen for oneself. I'd say that's pretty much the same as the freedom dividend. The only difference is how and when those resources are made available, and to what can be done with those resources provided by the freedom dividend are left up to the imaginations of the people getting them. Some things, to a degree, can be imagined under a Yang presidency. For example, Andrew is for molten salt nuclear reactors using thorium as fuel. The opportunities in that field are huge. New forms of electricity, creating very rare and useful fission products from nuclear waste, for nuclear medicines, for cancer using alpha emitters instead of only beta emitters, as we currently use, and a lot less shortage of these medical isotopes for both alpha and beta emitters. New nuclear fuel for deep space or deep water exploration. NASA is running out of them. Saltwater desalination plants from the heat created by very hot salts used by MSR. MSR, again, is molten salt reactor. Direct diesel fuel substitutes that are carbon-free. That's what engineers and scientists might do. For others, it might be something with arts. No one knows just yet, but opportunity is around the corner under a President Yang. And we won't need to hand out a couple of million shovels just to give someone a job. And a job that works against climate change. Having said that, I actually thought Professor K's argument was rather thoughtful and fair and open-ended." To which Mario responds, "You miss the elephant in the room. Everyone in this country is robbed of their opportunity. Why? For a true equal society, everyone would have to be granted land," all caps, land, "or indirect money," in quotes, "that would represent the average land's net. But some people are born with nothing, others with land and resources. So you, as a nobody, are forced to work," forced in quotes, "while actually being robbed of the ability to work for yourselves since you own no land and thus no resources to use. You have then to enslave to a master, and freedom of choosing your slave master is not freedom. It also doesn't matter if property, land, resources are owned by private or state, since a corrupt state will use the land for dubious reasons and still deprive you of the land." All right, so this seems to be somebody who is not only a supporter of Andrew Yang, but a devotee, or at least an appreciator of Henry George. It was Henry George who most famously suggested the land tax, and I'll talk about that in the next segment. Here we are. It is the next segment. For you, no time has passed. For me, I got scared there for a second. I thought hours had passed. I had a few errands to run, came home, sat down in the easy chair, took a little nap, opened my eyes. It's dark. I thought, oh my God, I've slept all afternoon. I have wasted my opportunity to get some work done. Look at the clock. It's not even 4 o'clock yet. Vermont is very far north. The winter days are short. Anyway, Georgism. I will be the first to admit I am no expert on Georgism. And I know that at least some of the people listening to this podcast know a fair amount about Georgism. Georgism is, well, as I often do, just to get us started, here is the above the table of contents Wikipedia entry for Georgism. Georgism, also called Geism or Geoism and single tax, is an economic ideology holding that while people should own the value they produce themselves, the economic value derived from land, often including natural resources and natural opportunities, should belong equally to all members of society. Developed from the writings of the economist and social reformer Henry George, the Georgist paradigm seeks solutions to social and ecological problems based on principles of land and public finance, which integrate economic efficiency with social justice. Georgism is concerned with the distribution of economic rent caused by natural monopolies, pollution, and the control of commons, including title of ownership for natural resources and other contrived privileges, for example, intellectual property. Any natural resource, which is inherently limited in supply, can generate economic rent, but the classical and most significant example of land monopoly involves the extraction of common ground rent from valuable urban locations. Georgists argue that taxing economic rent is efficient, fair, and equitable. The main Georgist policy recommendation is a tax assessed on land value. Georgists argue that revenues from a land value tax, LVT, can be used to reduce or eliminate existing taxes, for example, on income, trade, or purchases, that are unfair and inefficient. Some Georgists also advocate for the return of surplus public revenue to the people by means of a basic income or citizen's dividend. Economists since Adam Smith and David Ricardo have observed that, unlike other taxes, a public levy on land value does not cause economic inefficiency. A land value tax also has progressive tax effects. Advocates of land value tax argue that they would reduce economic inequality, increase economic efficiency, remove incentives to underutilize urban land, and reduce property speculation. The philosophical basis of Georgism dates back to several early thinkers such as John Locke, Baruch Spinoza, and Thomas Paine. But the concept of gaining public revenues, mainly from land and natural resource privileges, was widely popularized by Henry George in his first book, Progress and Poverty, 1879. Georgist ideas were popular and influential during the late 19th and early 20th century. Political parties, institutions, and communities were founded based on Georgist principles during that time. Early devotees of Henry George's economic philosophy were often termed single taxers for their political goal of raising public revenue mainly from a land value tax, although Georgists endorse multiple forms of rent capture as legitimate. The term Georgism was invented later, and some prefer the term geoism to distinguish their beliefs from those of Henry George. And I want to describe to you the image that is associated with this Wikipedia entry. It is a black and white, sort of sepia-toned, actually, photograph of a billboard. This is from 1914, and the billboard was put up in Rockford, Illinois. It's in a what looks like to be just a vacant lot between two buildings, and the billboard reads as follows. Everybody works but the vacant lot. I paid $3,600 for this lot and will hold till I get $6,000. The profit is unearned increment made possible by the presence of this community and enterprise of its people. I take the profit without earning it. For the remedy, read Henry George. Yours truly, Fay Lewis. So, you know, there was a time in my life when I got a big chunk of money. It's when I cashed out of my Amazon, you know, I cashed out my Amazon stock options. You know, turned them into stock, sold them in one transaction, got a bunch of money. That money's long gone. I sometimes fantasize about what I could do with that money if I could go back to, what was it, 1998, the fall of 1998, and get that money again with knowledge of the future. I mean, some things don't require a whole lot of very specific knowledge, just sort of perspective. Like, land values increase. Had I taken that money and just gone and bought a house in San Francisco, and just sat there for a decade or two, that money would have, you know, but of course, knowing how the stock market was going to perform, and knowing specifically which of the tech companies from the late 1990s would, you know, hold on and build themselves into big empires and which would fade away, really the one of the best things I could have done with my Amazon stock was just leave it as stock and hold on to it. But basically all of the, you know, the fantasy scenarios that I play out, they simply involve me catching a piece of the increase in value of something, either a piece of real estate or several pieces of real estate or, you know, stock in a company, but it's all speculation and it's all basically cheating at speculation because I know the future. In none of these sort of fantasy scenarios, am I really creating anything of value? I mean, I like to think that if I was a billionaire, I would engage in some worthy billionaire philanthropy, but still that's like, you know, the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma paying back 2% of the, you know, the profits that they made on OxyContin in out-of-court settlements and fines and whatnot, you know, for having created this enormous addiction epidemic. So back to Georgism, back to the land tax, because I get messages from people just out of the blue who simply assert that the only fix for our, you know, gross distortion of wealth and privilege and quality of life is a land tax. And, you know, when somebody that I don't know contacts me out of the blue and makes some absolute certain statement of intent or policy, or, you know, they're absolutely asserting that, you know, the mainstream belief system on some topic is absolutely wrong and they've got the answer, to me that just smacks of fanaticism. You know, it's a sort of a cultist mentality, even though, you know, certain fanaticism, certain cult-like mentalities appeal to particularly smart people. So I'm not saying that, you know, the person who contacts me and this is how they're leading, I'm not saying they're not worth getting to know or they're not worth listening to. It's just that the insistence on some particular piece of, you know, idealized policy, like a land tax or, you know, the freedom dividend, it just comes across as dogmatic and a little spiral-eyed, you know, a little, the person who is mouthing these words has been captured. Their brain and their body and their mouth is in the service of a co-adapted meme complex. They are a meme bot in the long discarded terminology of the incipient science of memetics from the 1990s. And, you know, I often go back to Yuval Noah Harari, and I can never read passages from the books because I didn't read the books. I just listened to them as audiobooks. So I just have my own, you know, fuzzy, shifting recollections of what he had to say. But I think it was Yuval Noah Harari in one of his books who was talking about how, while Silicon Valley generates enormous wealth these days, you can't pull a Roman Empire and just roll in there and conquer the territory and seize the silicon mines of Silicon Valley and, you know, have and just and capture the wealth of Silicon Valley that way. The wealth of Silicon Valley, while, you know, the real estate where these companies sit is very valuable, the value doesn't come from the land. It kind of comes from the land in that you have a bunch of venture capitalists all located in one place. You have a bunch of different high-tech, you know, industries in one place. You've got military contractors there. You know, you've got banks. I mean, you've got a lot of different interdependent economic entities which have clustered in a place, but it's not the place itself that is so valuable. If they all decided to go someplace else because suddenly, you know, the assessed value of the land that they're sitting on cut into their profits, they could and they would. It's not the land itself that is generating the wealth. And, you know, the more we move into algorithmically generated wealth that requires fewer and fewer human bodies, the specific land on which those algorithms, you know, are run is less and less relevant. It is less and less a key aspect of the economic venture. So while, you know, the Romans could go and invade Germania or Gaul and seize the land and, you know, put new governors in place in these newly conquered territories and, you know, charge them with collecting taxes and you know, pulling food out of the ground, basically, by managing farm labor. Back then, wealth really did come out of the ground. Most people worked in agriculture in some form or another. And wealth came either from going and conquering new lands and, you know, just taking their gold and silver and coinage and whatnot, and also occupying that land and determining, you know, what gets grown there and what happens to the proceeds of that agricultural endeavor. And of course, the land that produced the most food was the most valuable, or land, you know, in places where it facilitated trade, that also gave it value. And those things are all still, you know, they contribute to the value of land, but most of our cereal agriculture, you know, our corn, our wheat, also our soybeans in the United States. I mean, if you just get on I-70 and drive from east to west or west to east, you can cross most of the country on that highway, and you will drive through just, you know, you'll spend hours and hours and hours driving through corn and wheat and soybean fields, mostly corn. You know, that land is in the Midwest. That land is in Illinois and Missouri and Kansas and Iowa and Nebraska. And while it's very productive agricultural land, in terms of the land value, it's not particularly valuable. It doesn't hold a candle to Seattle. It doesn't even hold a candle to, like, Greensboro, North Carolina, where you've got a lot of biotech industries. It is the clustering of those biotech companies in and around Greensboro, North Carolina, and the other two cities that make up the triangle there that, you know, create a lot of wealth. It is bizarre. You know, you can drive through the South and you'll drive through all these abandoned, you know, like dried up husks of old towns that, you know, barely exist anymore. Many of them really don't exist anymore. I mean, they used to have a local government. They used to have local schools, and now they don't. It's just, you know, a bend in the road where you've got a bunch of buildings where, you know, that used to be the economic center of a town, but that town doesn't even exist anymore. It has been incorporated into some larger geographical entity. And, you know, you see buildings just falling into ruin. You see houses that are, you know, you can't believe people live there. It's like they're half disintegrated. And then you drive through an area like Greensboro, and suddenly everything is beautiful. Everything is well maintained. You know, there's landscaped verges between opposite lanes of traffic. I mean, everything is just taken care of because you've got a bunch of corporations which have clustered here, and which, you know, trade employees. They don't willingly trade employees. They poach employees from one another. But still, it's a place where, and it's also close to educational institutions, and there's just a network of interacting economic actors, entities, which have clustered in this particular place. But the particular place isn't all that particular. It's, I don't want to say it's random. It's more contingent, but it could be moved. The whole wealth-generating engine of this interacting, you know, network, this matrix of actors, could be replanted elsewhere. And I understand that the land tax is, you know, it's not a uniform tax. It is based on the value of the real estate, and that the value of the real estate is generated by, you know, the activity of the people doing business there. But this whole land tax idea, it just seems so agrarian to me. I understand that, like, for example, it's not just land that is would be taxed. It is, you know, natural scarcities, natural monopolies. So, for example, mineral rights, fossil fuel companies, oil companies, you know, they raise a lot of capital. They pay people, you know, with high-tech skills to go and do what is necessary to get oil out of the ground, but they didn't make the oil. And I think it's fair to say, yeah, sure, you did a lot of work, you marshaled a lot of expertise to get that oil out of the ground. You deserve some compensation for those efforts, but you didn't make the oil. You're not an oil company, you're an oil extraction company. The oil is the common property of everybody. Everybody where, though? Everybody within 100 miles of the oil? Everybody within the same country as the oil? Everybody in the earth? Certainly, we're not doing a global assay of all natural wealth and, you know, deciding on its value and then dispersing it to everybody in the world equally. So there are complications, but I can certainly see, you know, in the example of fossil fuels, that there should be some recognition that the people profiting off of the extraction of those fuels didn't create them, and that those, you know, potential fuels, those hydrocarbon deposits, really should be considered the shared property of everybody. It should be a public resource or a community resource, and it's not treated that way. So in that respect, I can certainly get on board with Georgism, but going forward, it seems that more and more wealth is being created or seized, you could say accumulated, by algorithmic means. Algorithms running on computers in some data center somewhere. Where? I mean, in several different data centers in many cases. And frequently, those data centers are out in the middle of nowhere because the land is cheap. I realize, for those Georgists listening, I realize that, one, I haven't done nearly enough research to really make a case against Georgism. And I'm telling you up front, admitting fully and taking ownership of the fact that what I'm reporting and trying to elaborate on is an impression. When people contact me with, you know, stars in their eyes about the miraculous powers of a land tax, it just sets off my cultist detector. You know, my spidey sense tingles and I think, uh-oh, alert, potential crazy person. Fortunately, they're contacting me, you know, on the internet. They're not up in my face. And again, a lot of people who are attracted to a lot of kooky ideas are very intelligent. There are certain kooky ideas that appeal more to intelligent people than they do to stupid people. For example, the flat earth hypothesis. That is a tease. I'm not going to go on about flat earthism. not in this episode anyway. It takes me too far afield. You know, the building I live in has a drive-through bank in it. It's actually a credit union, and it's my bank, and it's really handy to be able to walk, you know, 5 seconds out my door and be at my bank. But I also get to see everybody who, you know, drives around the building to go through the drive-through. They drive right past my window, below me. I'm on the second floor. And today, the bank closed, I think at 2, you know, because it's the day before Thanksgiving. And I'm just watching this sad parade of all these people who didn't realize that the bank closed early today, driving, you know, in circles around the bank. And it's funny because, you know, cars, they don't have eyebrows. They don't have facial muscles. They don't have shoulders. They don't have all of the, you know, the anatomical features that we look to for body language, but it just seems that the cars themselves are exuding this sad, dejected body language of, oh shit, the bank is closed and it won't open again until next week. But back to Georgism for just a second. Georgists, why is this land tax, this single land tax idea relevant in the age of surveillance capitalism, in the age of artificial intelligence, in the age of massive, ubiquitous surveillance and social control? All right. And then to close this out, I want to go back to something that we were talking about, or I suppose I was talking about and you were listening to me talk about early in the podcast, which is the idea of a new scorecard, a new way to measure how well we're doing as a country. Right now, you know, our primary metric is gross domestic product. Basically, how much business are we doing? How much money is changing hands? And obviously, that doesn't capture questions about, you know, how happy are people or how equitably is that wealth distributed. But there's a problem with it beyond that. And to articulate that problem, I'm going to turn to a longtime Sea Realm guest who I think just last week was interviewed by Kevin Lynn. Kevin Lynn is the person who runs the political organization that pays me to write and draw the weekly comic strip. He has been on the Sea Realm podcast a few times, and he's been here on the Vault a few times. He recorded an interview with Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry Orlov, who now lives in Russia. I don't know if you knew that. I didn't know that until I watched and listened to this interview with Kevin Lin. And in it, Kevin Lin went to Politicon, and Politicon was in Nashville, Tennessee this year. And he went and he recorded, you know, some of the panel discussions, and there's another sad car slowly rolling past my window. And Kevin went to a panel that was talking about, the panel was called Russia, Russia, Russia. Just the absolute fixation on the idea, you know, if it was lefties criticizing right-wingers for this, they'd call it a conspiracy theory. But we'll just say the idea that President Donald Trump is a Russian asset who is doing the business of Vladimir Putin at every turn, and who won, you know, in quotations, won the 2016 election by means of an unfair advantage granted to him by subterfuge from Russia. You know, if you listen to this podcast, and I know you do, you know, I think that's not only nutty, but it's just really irresponsible. So irresponsible, because it is simply a refusal to acknowledge all of the things, all of the policies, all of the conditions that have caused longtime, you know, Democratic voters to say, fuck you to the Democratic Party. The idea that people in swing states voted for Obama twice and then turned around and voted for Donald Trump, the idea that it's Russia that did that and it has nothing to do with the policies of Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, it's understandable, but it's not excusable. The Democratic Party establishment and those people who are well off and don't want to look at the lives of the people who are really struggling in this economy and who support business-as-usual Democrats like Joe Biden or Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg, their refusal to acknowledge that the DNC policies, the neoliberal policies of the Democratic Party establishment, have caused hardship, have caused pain for the electorate. The obsession with Russia is emblematic of this failure to do any sort of critical self-reflection on the part of the moneyed class. As Crystal Ball likes to say, the professional managerial class. Anyway, I've gone a little far afield. This is supposed to be a setup for a clip from the interview between Kevin Lin and Dmitry Orlov. The whole interview, it's more than an hour long. It is available on YouTube. And it starts off with Kevin introducing and playing clips from this Russia, Russia, Russia panel and Dmitry Orlov responding to it. So here we go.
But folks might recognize him from MSNBC. Like he'll describe here, he's a former intelligence officer. And this, I think, sets the tone.
Because that's all we hear about all day and all night. But I'm going to focus on the Trump-Russia scandal. Principally, it's not just because I wrote three books on the matter. It's because, as an intelligence, former intelligence professional, I recognize the threat that Russia presents to the world today. Let's get a couple of things straight. I just want to stipulate some things, and I've said this on television many times. Russia is a trailer park with atomic bombs, okay? They do not have a very large economy. We have more trade with Chile than we do with Russia. Russia produces weapon systems, oil, and natural gas.
Okay, Dmitry. So tell me, is the Russian economy nothing more than a trailer park with atomic weapons?
Well, that's actually, you know, absolutely hilarious, because this person clearly doesn't have much of a grasp of facts. Now, you can look at the size of the economy in dollars or euros at the current conversion rate. But that's relatively meaningless. What you have to take into account is how far the money goes. You know, there are lots of examples of that. For instance, I can go downstairs right now and have a really good meal, you know, the sort of thing that I like to eat since I'm Russian. So I like to have a three-course meal, you know, borscht for soup. Then I'll have blini for the main course meal, and then I'll have a compote, which is stewed fruit for dessert. If I were to try to find that in Manhattan, it wouldn't cost me $3. It would cost me $70, and it wouldn't be as good. So that's, you know, purchasing parity. There are lots of other similar examples. If I were to need an appendectomy while on a visit to the United States, no insurance, that would probably cost me on the order of $60,000 to $80,000. If that were to happen to me in Moscow, that would cost me $2,000. See the difference?
Absolutely.
So in the United States, they register the ridiculous cost of doing various things as their GDP. And based on that, they claim that their economy is absolutely huge. Of course, what they're doing is they're gouging each other. The Americans are gouging each other. The Russians are not. And therefore, the Russian economy looks small. But if you take the purchasing parity into account, it turns out that the Russian economy is sixth largest in the world after Germany. But then Germany has been dropping by single digits, sometimes more, in terms of its industrial production, and moving factories very aggressively to Russia. So Mercedes built a factory in Russia. Lots of, I talked to a German consultant yesterday whose job is moving as many factories out of Germany and into Russia as possible. So Germany is going to be sixth largest pretty soon, and Russia is going to be fifth largest. And there aren't that many countries that are that big. There's China, followed by the United States, followed by India, followed by Japan, followed by Russia. Now, Japan is probably going to be the next one. Japan is the reason Russia will be fourth largest in the coming years. I don't think Russia will ever surpass India, though, just because of the size of the population. So this fellow just doesn't have his numbers right.
So this fellow just doesn't have his numbers right. This fellow is Malcolm Nance. And I just, looking for the correct spelling of his name, I stumbled across an article written by Isaac Chotiner in the New Yorker. And the article is called Malcolm Nance on the Danger of Conspiracy Theories. So I'm going to read just the first couple of paragraphs, not even getting into the interview, just the setup for it. Malcolm Nance, a former naval intelligence officer and an MSNBC contributor, has become one of the most recognizable voices on Trump-related scandals. According to Brian Williams, MSNBC's chief anchor, Nance is, quote, a cross between Batman and Fight Club, close quote. The weekend morning host Joy Reid called Nance, quote, very rational. Even though the things that he's telling you will completely freak you out, he's super knowledgeable, but he's also that calming friend, close quote. Nance, however, has been frequently criticized by both the left and the right for promoting false and unproven claims, often having to do with Russia. In March, Nance tweeted that he was convinced that Carter Page was an FBI double agent. He has written of Trump, quote, little comes from his mouth that was not put there by shaping actions and experiences with Russians and was carefully planned to benefit the Russian Republic, close quote. This month on Morning Joe, he claimed that the Russian government had been looking for ways to exploit Trump since the mid-80s. Quote, Donald Trump sees the world only through Moscow's point of view, close quote. In 2016, Nance wrote the best-selling book, The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, which he followed up with another bestseller, The Plot to Destroy America, How Putin and His Spies Are Undermining America and Dismantling the West. He has written what could be considered the third part of a trilogy, The Plot to Betray America, How Team Trump Embraced Our Enemies, Compromised Our Security, and How We Can Fix It. I recently spoke by phone with Nance, whose intelligence work included stints in the Middle East and North Africa. During our conversation, which has been edited for length and clarity, we discussed his fears about the Trump presidency, whether he believes Trump and members of his circle are foreign agents, and the danger of a public square full of conspiracy theories. How delightfully self-contradictory that this guy, Malcolm Nance, is concerned about the danger of a public square full of conspiracy theories. Now, all that said, Mockingtone included, I do believe that the Russian government devotes material, financial, and human capital to the task of basically finding the weak points in American culture, the places where classes, races, genders, and, you know, any other classification that you can think of, all the places where we rub up against each other the wrong way, I have no doubt that the Russians are doing what they can to exacerbate that. But without our own failings, the ones that we impose upon ourselves with our economic policies, there would be nothing to exploit. And I repeat, the Democrats, who insist that the current president is a tool of Russia, that Hillary Clinton really did win the 2016 election, and that the last 4 years don't count, they're not only wrong, they're not only irresponsible and self-interested to a fault, they are blinkered, they are obtuse, they are blind to their own failings to a degree which cannot help but come back and bite them in the ass with such force and vigor and severity that they will be missing an ass cheek. Unfortunately, they are the power brokers of our society, or at least, you know, a good portion of the power brokers of our society, and they cannot suffer vicious injury without our bleeding as well. They, I'm externalizing and othering them, they are part of this nation, they're part of this society, they count among us. We don't share in their opulence, but we will share in their pain. We will suffer with their destruction, deserved as it is. So while I'm no longer a fast collapse peak oil doomer, it is not to say that there isn't a lot of pain to endure and get through on the near horizon. And with that very optimistic appraisal of the situation that we stand in right now, let me wish you a happy Thanksgiving 2019. Stay well, feast, make merry, reconnect with people that you care about, and buckle in, because 2020 is going to be a doozy. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.